Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. I'm Rory Hearn, your host, and today I'm joined by Mr. Niall Breslin. Niall, delighted to have you here in the podcast.
I'm delighted to be here, Rory.
Great. I have to say, it's great to have a fellow Ga man, you know. Like, I'm mad into Waterford hurling, you know. I come from Tramore. I was shite, though. I never played. And well, I did play, like, but never made it. I just about made it onto the junior team. But you played some serious football for...
Not for Tramore.
No,
actually,
I know.
I was only in Tramore this week. What a beautiful place.
That is great,
like,
isn't it?
Tramore and Dunmore East are, like, absolute.
Yeah.
It was, mind you, the weather was stunning as well. But wow, what a gaff to be from. I was a kind of default athlete, is the best way to describe it. I grew up in a house that was just music. My mum's a music teacher, my brother was a music kind of mad. So music was kind of my first port of call, and then I kind of started growing into myself a little bit, and I played every sport, but the sport that I, even though I played professional rugby in the end, the sport I missed the most is Gaelic football.
Yeah.
It's just, its beauty is its simplicity. It's such a simple sport. And I loved it. I loved being part of the club. I loved the way they looked after me. I loved everything about it. And that kind of just naturally grew into, I played county and minor and under 21s. And we had good underage teams in Westmead. But yeah, I do. I really miss Gaelic football. Mm. I can't tell you why, but my last coach was Paddy O'Shea. That's probably one of the reasons.
That would definitely be one of the reasons. But sport or kind of athleticism or I don't know what we call it now when we're in our whatever age. I won't say what age we are. But anyway, in this stage of life, when we're not doing professional athleticism, kind of, is it still important to you doing kind of, I suppose, exercise and...
It is. I think it's really... Do you know one thing I've noticed, Rory, is my relationship with exercise has changed quite a lot. Because I used to, apart from being when it was my job and I was playing professional sports, that's when I started to not enjoy it for an abundance of reasons. It became very controlled then. You had to do certain things. I mean, that's professional sport. You have to adhere to teams. And what I used to love about sport was the wildness of it, the spontaneity of it. You just went out and it was just rawness. You just let it go and see what happened. I used to love that, especially with Gaelic. But then when she became professional, it was, you know, it was house rules apply.
Yeah.
And I get that completely, but it wasn't my thing. But then when I retired from rugby, I played Gaelic briefly, but I then went through this weird period where I became utterly obsessed with exercise.
Yeah.
Really weirdly. Like, I think I was trying to qualify for the Olympic Games, you know, and what I was doing was I was fucked up, and I was obsessed. I was obsessively exercising, and we do that with exercise because it's a healthy pastime. You get people who go to the gym 5 times a day, and I always think, you're not fooling anyone. There's something up there, you know, and I don't mean that because I was that guy. And now my relationship with exercise is really, really organic and nice, and I call it movement and rather than exercise. And I like setting goals and the odd time, but I used to be that guy. I have to do an Ironman, and I had to stop that because it wasn't going the right way for me.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because I would have as well. I didn't get to an Ironman. Now, half Ironman was my completion, but I became obsessed as well with getting my time down when I was, you know, and you know, you're just chasing your demons, chasing them, they're chasing you, and it is absolutely, you know, an addiction. But it's interesting, the sports, I think, is interesting because I suppose what, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about equality and equality of access. And sport is something that it interests me because there's a very, it's like there is huge social class division in sport, is there not? Access to it, been able to engage with it. And I think particularly as you get older, you see that it is, you know, the access to having the time, the access to having the physicality, the health, the mental health to be able to do it, you see the social class division between people who are able to have that time and people who are, you know, working, you know, essentially to try and survive.
Well, like, you look at something like triathlon, which has become a massive sport, and cycling. Of all the sports I've ever done, it's the most expensive one.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I saw lads who weren't paying their mortgages to buy bikes.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen lads spending, you know, 500, 600, 700 quid in a wetsuit just to, in this belief that it's going to take a minute off their time.
And
like, I could see where it was going, and there is definitely barriers. I call it equality in sport. If there's barriers to entry, then it's not, there's an equality issue in that sport, and it's not no one's fault. You know, it's not like people set out to have an elitist sport. It's just certain sports are expensive. And I think that's why something like the GAA is so essential in communities, because although the GAA have had interesting past in some regards in terms of, you know, slightly conservative in certain approaches, but all in all, they've been critically important to communities across Ireland. They were to my community. So there is equality issues in sport. There always will be. And then if you look down the kind of to kind of younger barrier, look, generally rugby was always seen as a quite elitist sport in Ireland. Not as much as the UK now, if I'm being honest. But in Ireland, there was that perception, because I played professional rugby, I must have went to a private school. I didn't go to a private school. I went, everyone went, everyone used to say he went to St. Mary's. I went, yeah, St. Mary's in Mullingar. Far from a private school. But there was that perception of it. But I do think with sport, sport has changed so much now, professional sport. Now, I'm losing interest in it by the day, to be honest with you. It's unfortunately turned into just a circus.
Corporate takeover, isn't it? It's completely...
And that's not me being a purist.
Yeah.
It's just, like, these lads are wearing... I remember when I did my first kind of Ironman, I had an amazing coach, to be fair to him. He was a really nice, amazing coach, Mark McCabe, and he gave me a lot of his time. And he kind of came up to me and he was like, you pushed too hard in this number and your numbers were wrong here and I had this down and this is how hard you could push. I went, you know what you're forgetting about, Mark? You're forgetting about the dog in a lad. The kind of stuff you can't measure.
Mm.
The stuff that science doesn't measure. That little bite when everything's against you and you just fucking grit your teeth and go for it. You don't add that. You can't get that in science. And I think in sport now, you're seeing the lads wearing the things on their back to say how many fucking farts they let in a match and how many steps they took.
Yeah.
We need to leave something to the beauty of sport and not make it all about sports science. I get performance at that level is down to literally millimeters if you want to succeed. But like, I love sport. What I loved playing sport, it was when there was a bit of magic to it, i.e. when the Irish football team went to Italy, when they went to America and your dad put you on the bonnet of his car after we bet feckin', you know, Romania and drove you around the town. And that to me is what I loved about sport. But now it's just got... I don't even watch soccer anymore. I've lost all interest.
It is interesting that the way in which it has become so commodified, and it's part of kind of everything under globalization and under the last 30 years is becoming commodified. Everything has been turned into something that can be bought, that can be sold, that can make some corporation huge money. And, you know, I think it's interesting because obviously what you have, you know, and what people would probably know you as much as your music for now is your, you know, work around mental health and campaigning on it and highlighting it, is that mental health is being commodified now. Mm. You know, the wellness industry, you know, and we look at it that, you know, how are you seeing that in terms of our response? Because it's really positive, I think, that, you know, in Ireland has changed so much. Thanks be to Christ. Like, you know, thanks be to Christ.
The irony, there you go. Now you're confusing everybody, Rory.
The nod to my Catholic past. Yeah. And present, of course, yes. Did I christen my children? I think some of them, yeah. Anyway.
You had to. Wouldn't have got into school.
Exactly. But we have changed so much, and one of the big areas we have changed in is our conversations around mental health, and it's nowhere near enough. And I know, you know, again, you and other organizations are doing great work, and we need to talk so much more, because people, you know, in my generation and others, and men in particular, and, you know, older generations still clam up when you talk about fucking sex, or you talk about, you know, vulnerability or pain or heartache or loss, and, you know, you go, what do I say? You just fold your arms and try and fold them stronger and harder, and, you know, seeking, you know, just disappear from where you are. But the thing about it is, I think, in terms of the whole commodification thing, is that selling it is that we're having the conversations, but is it just turned into a product?
Yes, in some cases it has. And it's really important, I suppose, when I started this journey. I remember the best way to describe this, in the 90s we commodified fitness. You know, we started selling infomercials, those ab machines that if you use them for 5 minutes a day, you'd have abs, which is horseshit, because now it's in my dad's shed that, you know, I never got abs. And
I've been looking at that Rome machine now in Halford.
There's one. Did you see the one I got on Facebook? And it kind of looks like you're having sex with the air. It's such a strange thing. There's nobody going to use it. But like, they put this ladder, and I swear to God, you could literally, like Michelangelo came back from the dead and hand chiseled his abs.
Yeah.
Because he's riding the air. But yeah, we commodified fitness in the 90s. And then what I noticed is, I look at the market about 6-7 years ago, all the only drink you could buy in the shop was energy drinks to give you the energy to keep up the pace of the world. So then the world copped on, oh fuck, everybody's overwhelmed. We got to sell them drinks to calm them down now.
Yeah.
So we've drinks that cure anxiety. It's just, it's the whole narrative and language has to, we have to be careful around it. And I have to be careful because I can only promote the fact that people now are talking about emotional well-being because that's what I call it, because everyone has mental health.
Yes, correct, yeah.
So the issue I'm seeing now is, for example, somebody would say to me, I have anxiety. I went, well, of course you have. Everybody has anxiety. It's essential. It's an essential trait of a human being. It's what keeps us alive. It's what keeps us safe and away from danger. There's a fundamental difference between anxiety and anxiety disorder. There is a really fundamental difference between having a shit day and depression. For anybody who's been diagnosed and lived with clinical depression, it is absolutely crucifying. There's a fundamental difference between OCD and, you know, washing your hands twice. It is, these are really serious and very difficult dysfunctional behaviors that people have. And what we have done, and I'm talking at kind of at the higher level, I'll get back to the stuff, you know, below that. What we also have done is we've clinicalized trauma in a lot of ways. For example, during this, a friend of mine, and I have to be very careful what I say here, because I was on medication for many years, for 12 years. In many cases, medication is absolutely required. But the problem being is, I had a friend who went in recently because he's struggling with this pandemic, as am I, as are you, as are everybody, because we're human
you
beings.
Absolutely.
This
can't
is tough stuff. And he went into his doctor, and I said, listen, I think you should go talk to your doctor and see, you know, if there's a program or there's something you can, I can help you out and get you, you know, a therapist, and we can talk through this, and we can talk through the overwhelm, where it's coming from, what are your triggers, that kind of stuff. He goes, yeah, okay, I will. And it's a big thing for him to do.
Yeah.
And he went to the doctor, and he sent me a picture, and it was 4 different types of tablets he gave him.
Yeah.
For somebody who's just having a tough time in a pandemic. And I just went, the first protocol of that GP, and this isn't the GP's fault because they know there's no system to send this guy into. They know there's no, like if he's sent into the public system for therapy, he could be waiting 2 years for it.
Yeah.
So I actually feel for the GPs in that regard. But that was the answer. And I just sat him down and said, what do you think? And he goes, I just need to talk to somebody. I went, well, talk to me, man. I'm your mate. Like there's only so much I can talk to you about.
Yeah.
And then I went, listen, I know a really good psychologist. I think you should talk to her. Which he did. And now he's, I wouldn't say he's in a great place, but now he's dealing with the triggers. So for me, it's how do we approach trauma? But then you talk about commodified wellness. Now, wellness is a different thing.
So
wellness has been utterly commodified because people, it is a $1 trillion business now. And what happened is in the area of physical wellness, in the area of emotional well-being, what we have now is people just saying, be positive all the time. Just think positively. Unicorns, care bears, cartwheels through the fucking meadow.
Yeah.
But the reality is any professional who would have studied this area or understands this area will tell you that the human brain doesn't know how to be positive all the time. And it shouldn't be. It's not meant to be. You're meant to be negative sometimes. You're meant to assess situations and hold your thoughts to account. You're meant to explore them. You're not meant to run from them. You're meant to deal with these things and build the psychological flexibility to deal with what is a shit show of a world. And what we're doing now to people is we're airbrushing all that out. Just be positive. And that's what the wellness industry is trying to say. So what happens is if Rory feels shit one day and he feels a bit down, you not only do you feel with the down, you're feeling guilty and shameful now because you go, I got lovely kids, I've got a good life, why am I feeling this way? The wellness industry said I should just be happy.
Yeah.
And now that gets confusing. And over a course of 5, 6, 7 months, that becomes an issue for you. And that to me is where the problem becomes. And look in the area of mindfulness where I've studied for 3 years now and I all my academic life has been studying mindfulness-based interventions and the science behind it, is the biggest area of commodification has been mindfulness. We call it MAC mindfulness. It's because it's been turned into this thing that people think if they just listen to this 5 minutes a day, that all their issues and stress. The first thing I say to people is, I need to find where that's coming from. Where is your overwhelm coming from? We can't bypass that stuff. We got to find a way to sit with that, to be with it, to figure out what's going on. And that is why in the work that I do, it's a much longer journey with people. The therapy that I give with the mindfulness-based interventions is a much longer journey. But it is the scenic route, but it's fucking beautiful because what you discover at the end of it can change your life. And that is why I'm passionate about it. And there's people who are in this industry who care greatly of what they can do to better take care of people so they can navigate the shit show of the world we live in. And that's why I set up A Lust for Life, because I believe that setting up an organization, rather than just talking about it and theorizing and giving out, I wanted to try achieve something with it. I wanted to get into schools. I wanted to tell young people not to go through what I went through. And that's the thing. Young people are just dealing with too much right now. So we are commodifying it. We'll commodify everything. We always will. But we shouldn't let that stop us having the conversations that we repressed for generations.
I completely agree. And I think that, you know, the conversation is so, so important, and normalizing, trying to, like, of course, you want to try and normalize the difficulties and the challenges that we face. And it's interesting because the reality is, you know, we all go through things that happen, you know, life happens, you know, people, you know, loss, grief, all these things, you know, trauma, cancer, it happens, you know, and it's how people respond. And, you know, you see children where it happens to, and it happens to them when they live in a disadvantaged area and they've got, you know, no supports around, and, you know, things just get built up and people end up being in very, very, you know, dark places. And I think that there's something about that I struggle with is at times is kind of the when it's seen as the individual's kind of fault, you know, and that it's somehow, this is something that I haven't done, and this is something I have to try and sort out myself, rather than actually there's this whole, as you talked about, you know, the shit show of society, you know, the nature of you know, the pressure on us to have the job, to be earning enough, to try and get housing, to try and, you know, be, you know, terrified about is if something happens to my kid, I have no health insurance, what's going to happen? That there's so many of the structures in society that create so much of our anxiety and so much of our, you know, anxiety, but also so many problems it causes. But yet so much of the responses are just about the individual.
Mm-hmm. I could talk to you straight now without taking a breath for 2 hours about exactly what you just said, because I believe firmly, my other background in the study was sociology. I've always been interested in how culture influences us and how we influence culture. And I don't know if you remember that scene in Good Will Hunting, really, really emotive scene when Robin Williams keeps saying to him, it's not your fault, it's not your fault. And he can't take that because he's never heard that, because he's conditioned all his life to believe that it was his fault, that it was his fault. And he couldn't even hear his therapist say that to him. It was like, I don't know what to do with that information. And that I remember thinking to myself, wow, because I've had not as Hollywood moment as that with my therapist, but it was that type of feeling of, you know, he took it off me.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm saying that is our culture is unwell.
Mm.
And we are swimming in a very sick sea. And we're wondering why we're overwhelmed. And unfortunately, our culture is starting to tap into the things that they know make us unwell, and the designs in our brain. And I could go down to get into the nitty gritty of evolutionary psychology, how our brains were designed. Our brains were designed for survival. An amazing, amazing survival tool, our brain. It's phenomenal. But it wasn't designed to give us accurate descriptions of reality. It isn't designed for that. It isn't designed for nuance. It's designed that I got to get the fuck out of here. I can't think about it for too much. And it hasn't evolved massively from there. And what's happened is in the modern world, neuroscientists often say it, we have an old brain for a new world. Our brains, I don't care, I've read the research and I've seen it, our brains can't cope with this, guys. Like, there's too much information coming, and it's the types of information that we're seeing. You know, every show, and the CEO of Netflix said that their biggest competitor in the marketplace isn't Amazon, isn't Facebook, it's sleep. We've commodified sleep.
Yeah.
We're commodifying everything in the marketplace. And what's happening is now we look online, and I mean, I'm not going to get the social media thing. Like, you can have any opinion you want. It is a cesspit, and it's doing far more damage than it's doing good. I love it. I love social media. There's some funniest feckers I've ever read in my life, I don't want to miss that stuff. But our culture is essentially designed now to infiltrate the chinks in our armor. And as Leonard Cohen says, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. But unfortunately, those cracks are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the issue being is that the likes of the tech companies, I don't know if you watch Social Dilemma on Netflix, it's a really hard watch. It's not subtle anymore. The major hires of a lot of these companies are psychologists to say to us, how do we get in to the vulnerability? The inventor of marketing, Edward Bernays, was Freud's nephew.
Yeah.
Like, do you not think Freud sat him down one day and went, do you want to make some serious money, dude? This is how you do it.
Yeah.
You know, and like, this is the reality. We've set up a culture that feels unwell. we've politics now that's never been sicker, in my opinion. It's insidious. It's hard to watch. It makes me feel unwell, but yet I can't stop. So for me, I look at culture and anxiety, especially among young people. And sometimes it's a better thing to give you an example of why I think culture. And actually, I'll be honest with you, not all the media, because we've seen recently how important media and good journalism is. It's essential to a functioning democracy. But the media are doing an inordinate level of damage because they have a war for your attention, and they're going to try and get your attention no matter what. It's become the new oil. It is a commodity now, and they have to fight for it because they're fighting for survival. But Love Island, I think it was 3 years ago on ITV, Love Island, which is essentially, and I'll be honest with you, I've actually never watched it.
Yeah.
I get the idea and the premise behind it.
I think I watched 10 minutes of it.
It's good looking lads and women shifting the face off each other, ripped to fucking shit in a beautiful sunny place. You know, I get it. Whatever, I can understand why it works. But the vast majority of that audience were young teenagers who basically saw that, they were obsessed by it.
Mm.
And that's where they wanted to go. And what did ITV do? They put ads for cosmetic surgery between each break.
Mm. Mm.
If you can't figure out how disgustingly sick that is, when we have eating disorders at an all-time high and body dysmorphia and other issues with young people, if you can't see how disgusting that is, there's something wrong.
Mm.
It's not subtle. Just today, while I was driving up, there was a radio ad that said, have you put on the dreaded COVID stone?
Yeah.
Do you have love handles? I went, can you not fucking gaslight me for literally 10 minutes in this pandemic till we all get our shit together?
Yeah.
And then they do these ads with nice piano music and somebody looking up in the distance like the Angelus and going, you know, stop gaslighting us. We are struggling now. And if you are listening to this and you're struggling, here's your brother. It's a pandemic. Don't try to be anything than just getting up, eating, having tea, getting your kids to school, watch a bit, scratching your hole. You don't need to achieve anything. You don't need to learn 5 fucking languages right now. You need to just be, get through this stuff. And I think that, to me, is real wellness. I think that is the reality of the human condition. And we need to stop. It's always been there. Since Bernays' days, it's always been there, but we've never consumed it at the level we're consuming it now, and it is killing our youth.
Yeah,
and we got to do something about it.
We absolutely do, and I think it is. It's something that I have been, you know, looking at is this, and trying to, you know, think about, particularly, you know, with young children, and with a teenager as well, the whole kind of the anxiety epidemic, this huge increase in the sense of anxiety amongst young people in Ireland, and going like, where the hell did this come from? And trying to break it down and go, you know, is it, and I was asking my son about it, you know, and he was saying, you know, it is, to a certain extent, it is about Trump, it's about climate, it's about, you know, the sense of hopelessness, and of course the mass information, you know, and even the ones who are politicized are getting this, you know, constantly bombarded with the images that we get on social media. But as adults, we can see it differently, and we can feel disempowered, and many of us do, or you can feel empowered, or you have some agency around it. But they have, you know, are been told anyway, and haven't been taught any sense of agency around it. It's just bombarded with this, and it's combined with what you're talking about there, this, you know, constant, it's the body image stuff, it's all the, you know, and then access to cheap food, and, you know, not being able to, you know, people traumatized, that what we're doing to young people, like, it's just like, how are they going to turn into adults? What sort of adults are they going to be?
Well, here's the thing. Here's my opinion on young people right now, is that the only people showing leadership in society right now are young people.
Mm.
There's an energy there, an energy that I haven't seen. I certainly didn't have it when I was young. It's an energy where injustice is causing an awful lot of anxiety, because we can call it what you want, the woke generation or whatever label you want to apply to it, because we love applying labels, because that makes marketing easy and it makes politics easy. You can call them whatever you want. You can call them Generation Z. You can call them whatever makes you happy. They're not a different generation. They're my generation. We're all the same generation. We all have to start living like that and stop labeling young people and start, like, looking at 3 Out Lads in the Late Late Show going, the problem with young people, have you asked them? Have you asked them? Have you sat down with them? Because I have.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm starting to find out things that I didn't know, things that I wasn't aware of. And my job as somebody who founded a mental health charity that is strategically based around young people is not to lead them. It is to be led by them and to facilitate that leadership. It is to empower them with any knowledge I might have and facilitate the changes that they need to see in their world. We need to meet them where they're at. And the problem now as well within society is, if you look, say, Extinction Rebellion, for example, as a movement, really powerful movement, such energy, exciting. And I, when I heard it, I was like, oh, these guys are balls. These guys are going for it. But when I heard them speaking, I didn't hear any calls to action. I didn't need any definitive kind of, what are we doing?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what I mean around activism. I would love to see people who understand activism, who maybe started the marriage equality campaign 15 years ago, because that didn't happen a few months before the second. That took 15 years of people like Noel Whelan sitting in a room going, how are we going to convince the Irish mammy to vote for this?
Yeah.
This takes time. And for me, I think it's the same thing. I think my generation and you can teach young people a lot because we care, and young people can teach us a lot. And when I talk about anxiety in young people, anxiety is driven by uncertainty. And they live in a very uncertain world right now. They live in an uncertain world that's not giving them the tools to cope, and we're further isolating them. Right now in the pandemic, we're saying young people are the problem here and they're having house parties. You know, the reality being is, yes, there are young people having house parties, and there are young people who aren't taking this seriously. But there's also many, many adults who aren't either. They're an easy target. Mm. And it's not helping us. And if a young 15-year-old is getting anxious by Donald Trump, that to me is an opportunity, because when I was 15, I didn't give a fuck who the president of America was. Mm. I didn't care about society. I just wanted to get, a shift and a feckin', blue wicked and whatever. I wasn't outwardly thinking as a teenager, but now our teenagers are, because they're caring about social justice, because they're aware of social injustice, because they now have something that shows it to them. And that is an opportunity, and we got to tap into it. And there's always going to be problems with my youth generation, our problem was we repressed every ounce of emotion we had,
and now, very successfully at times,
unbelievably good at it, which left us, the only time we showed any form of like outwardly external emotion was in confessions, when you shat yourself because you thought you were going to forget the act of sorrow, and you're like making shit up as you sat there, even though you wanted to say to them, yes, I have wanked.
Yeah. Or Westmeath won the All-Ireland in your dreams.
Yeah, absolutely. What a terrible thing to think. So the thing about it is, we have options here. We have options to empower our youth to get behind them, or we have options to label them. So you decide as an individual what you want to do. Stop looking at others. Take some personal responsibility here. I know what I want to do, and I know what our organisation wants to do, and that is to empower our youth to build a better world, because we fucked it up for them. And I really believe that I wish I had the balls as a 15, 16-year-old to stand up to the injustices that were happening in Ireland. Because you remember when I was 15, or even younger than that, there was women being put in prisons for having kids out of wedlock in the 80s. Imagine, I would like that happen now. Our youth would be tearing the streets apart. They wouldn't let that happen. And this isn't socialism. This isn't fucking overly woke. This isn't anything. This is humanity. We have to stop labeling everything to suit our own agendas, our own confirmation biases, because we're too terrified about change. It's hilarious to see rich white men fucking terrified by a 15-year-old teenage girl. It's beautiful to watch it, because there's one way to terrify a rich white man. It's in any way question their power. In any way tell them that power might be in question. That will make them shit themselves and act in all sorts of ways.
But is it not necessary as well that we have to be specific as well, and we have to be clear and develop? We, and I mean young people and those who want progressive, who want to see an Ireland of equality and social justice, that we have to develop concrete aims as well. That in a way that was part of the problem with the likes of Extinction Rebellion, that there wasn't a clear demand there, and obviously people say yes, there was, but there's going to be, if we really, really want to see a world and a country that values people for who they are, there's radical change is needed. Power is going to have to be challenged, and some aspects of society radically changed, aspects of our economy radically changed, how we work, equality, these things. So that requires taking on power.
how do you take power on? That's the thing. That is the thing I'm most interested in, because I am and always have been solution based. I've always believed in calls to action. I've always believed in, if you're going to try and convince people, they need to know exactly what you're convincing them of. And I think that is one of the issues in some of the activism that we are seeing in the world. And I listen actually a lot to Barack Obama. Now, I wasn't his biggest fan. I mean, everyone, he is literally the most, like, compared to what we have. But, like, he had his issues as well,
yeah,
as a president. But, like, that's not what this is about. But the reality is what he does understand is activism. And he made this speech recently where he said, activism isn't shouting at people on Twitter. It is not cancelling people. That is not activism. We have to start changing that. If you want to convince people, you need to learn how to debate. You need to learn how to have these dialogues, because then you can convince them. The marriage equality campaign was a prime example. Repeal the 8th was another incredible example. And I'll give you kind of, once again, I always believe it's good to kind of tell stories around this to see what, to kind of explain my story. I had a friend who unfortunately knew that the child that he was going to have wasn't going to survive. And this was through the whole repeal. So it was a very difficult period for this family, as you could imagine. And we were having a conversation around repeal, and one of the girls that was in the conversation got very heated about it, and kind of, he said, listen, I'm really confused. She didn't know his situation, to be fair. She goes, I'm really confused. And she just screamed at him, called him all sorts of things, and he just got a bit upset and walked away. And I went after him, and I sat him down, and I said, like, I understand this must be really difficult for you. And he goes, I'm so confused. And he told me what he was confused about, and I listened to him, and I said, as hard as this might feel for you right now, this isn't about you. This is about choice. And that was enough for him to go, oh, wow, you're right. You see, if I just continued to scream at him, nothing would have changed. I opened the dialogue. I saw the world from his point of view. I tried to find an island to meet him on. And it was enough. And that's the difference. We don't have that on Twitter. We don't have that on Facebook. We don't have that nuance. And if we want to change the world, we have to try and see the world from the people's points of view that we don't agree with, because they're the people you're trying to. You're not trying to change the people's minds who already agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point in that? They're with you already. It's the people who don't. And you will not change their mind by ripping their heads off or cancelling them. You will change them. I know there's some now, there's some examples where that's completely, yeah, they're lost causes because they're just simply, but there is opportunity there to at least attempt to go, right, guys, can we find a middle ground here so I can understand your point of view? So that's one point of activism that's gone on social media that we've lost, because when we communicate, 93% of how we communicate is assigned to body language and tone of voice, and 7% are just to words. So we don't have that 93%. And what that 93% happens online is made up of what you already think of that person anyway. So if Piers Morgan makes an amazing statement that's really amazing, you go, fucking idiot.
Yeah.
You know, because that's our mental model of them. So that's one part of activism. But then what Barack Obama said about activism is, you've got to understand the cogs of economics, the cogs of politics, the cogs of all these other parts of society to drive that change. It can't just be one thing. It has to be a holistic approach to driving change. That's how you get people on your side. And that is what I think is the change that we have to see. And Ireland still has a long way to go, because I look in Ireland, for example, that we've had this beautiful, powerful movement for equality in Ireland around marriage equality, around women's rights, that has been really, for me, just quite uplifting to see that it can happen. But where is the same passion and the same drive for socioeconomic equality? Where is that drive? I know it's not the same thing, but you're certainly not going to see like big corporate companies putting socioeconomic flags across there. You're not going to see Costa Coffee doing, because, you know, that's the reality. And that equality can't be pick and mix. It can't be where you choose to apply it. You either believe in equality or you don't. You cannot decide who you believe in it for or who you don't. That is not equality. And that is the very definition of it. So I think equality is it's a utopian world we all want to get to. How to get there, I haven't a fucking clue. But all I know is I want to try. In the space that I work in, and I think the best way to try is not me. I'm too old and battered at this point. It's young people, and I think they will drive the change that hopefully this generation can destroy the stigma that destroyed my generation.
I think that's, you know, it sums up a sense of hope that, you know, the change the change is possible. And I think it's really positive to see someone, you know, coming from your perspective, in a sense of, you know, a lot of times, you know, engagement of people who've, you know, are, we put them as famous, right? Mm. The engagement is so shallow with causes or with issues that it's a breath of fresh air to meet someone who's like, you know, you're really thinking this through and have thought it through and are coming to a place of, you know, a very, you know, a broad perspective. And it's really, it's interesting to hear the kind of the desire for socioeconomic, you know, equality, because I think in many ways, what you see when we look at direct provision or we look at homelessness or we look at generation rent, you know, entire generation that will not get housing on our current model, or we look at poverty, deprivation, you know, gone through the roof during COVID, that the real, that these are real issues that require challenging, as I said earlier, the structures of power. But I think it's interesting that, you know, you've come at it and you're coming at it through, in a sense, this idea of dialogue and coming at it through mental health as well. Do you see Ireland becoming, do you see us addressing those socioeconomic issues?
I think the socioeconomic issues that we see in Ireland has to start with the fact that some of our current leaders have a really strange perception of what equality is.
Mm.
Their language is damaging. It's elitist. It puts equality down to the fact that if you don't have good things, you obviously are lazy and didn't work hard for them.
Yeah.
That's the narrative that unfortunately has been kind of peddled over the recent number of years. Especially considering we had the one of the worst recessions we've ever had, it became much easier to tell that story. And the reality being is, I have a very lucky upbringing. I have five siblings. My dad was in the army. My mum was a working mother. I had a very loving background, but I was always aware of inequality.
Mm.
It was always something that became. In my school, I remember thinking about this and going home and crying about it. There was a young traveller kid in our class, and we had PE, and we were told, because we had to use the big gym, which was like, you know, wood, lovely wood, that we had to wear our runners that day. And he came in a pair of football boots with no studs, and the teacher bet the shit out of him.
Mm.
He couldn't afford runners.
Yeah.
He had boots. You know, he was slipping all over the fucking place.
Yeah.
And I remember going home to my mum going, what is that? Like, you, cause my dad at the time was the president of Fianna Fáil, so we would have, in Mullingar, we would have seen a lot of the families. And I started to see poverty and started to not understand why poverty exists. Now, in the 80s, our family, we were never wealthy, but, like, money was a thing.
Yeah.
You know, you were brought up on potato waffles, and, you know, my mum kills me when I say that, but, like, genuinely, I remember treats. I remember stuff like that. And
the He-Man bars.
Yeah, the
Sunday.
He-Man bars. And and my treat was Rolos. And I do remember this stuff, but I just remember being very affected by inequality and not understanding it, because I'd never experienced it. Now, if you look at my training in studying of Buddhism, that's the story of the Buddha. The Buddha lived in this beautiful palace. Now, I didn't live in a palace. I lived in a little gap in Mullingar. He lived in this palace, and he'd never seen pain.
Yeah.
Because he was never exposed to it. And one day he went, you know what, fuck this. I'm going for a walk. And his mum and dad were like, where are you going? Where are you going? You can't leave the palace.
Yeah.
I said, nah, fuck it. I'm going for a walk. I don't know if he used that language, but I have a feeling like the little pudgy Buddha going, fuck you, mum. I'm going for a walk.
Rebelling
against his parents. And he went for a walk, and he saw a homeless person. He was like, what's that?
Yeah.
It's a homeless person. He's like, and then he saw a sick person, go, what's that? It's a sick person. He was like, why is there so much pain in the world? Because he goes, you've never just, it's always been there. You've just not been exposed to it. And then he went and lived under a tree for the rest of his life and figured out why this exists.
Mm.
And that to me is why inequality, I suppose, in my studies became something important, because I think it's at the root of a lot of Buddhism as well. And like, we break inequality. A lot of psychologists will say the same thing to you. Equality is the best form of therapy.
Mm.
And your first 1,000 days of a child's life has a profound impact on their psychology and brain development. And in some cases, like, if I'm being honest with you right now, because I suppose I work with people who work in the social system as well.
Yeah.
We can keep this quiet. We can say this, that, and the other. It is heartbreaking what's going on there. It's heartbreaking that there's kids being basically thrown around different homes because they've been abused or beaten up, or they've no stability. They've no chance. And this, to me, as you said, somebody in the public eye who I like, this doesn't really allure you to brands talking like this.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't. You know, but it is, for me, all, like, I've noticed in this, in the public sphere as well, like, I, you know, I don't want to be a brand.
Mm.
You know, that's not going to change anything. And I ask myself this sometimes, because I'm in a position now where I'm going, like, fuck, I need to get my shit together and buy a home and get me, you know, life together. I invested most of my time in starting Us for Life, getting it going. But now I have to actually pull the big boy pants up and start doing shit. But I really break it breaks me down to that. This is the one thing that makes me feel good, is to actually go, I don't agree with how the world's operating now. Mm. I don't agree with how our social system's working and how our socioeconomic equality. And I really struggle with our political narrative right now that if you're homeless, if you don't have a job, if you don't get up before 9 o'clock, like, that's doing huge damage, because all that does is says to the people who are paying their taxes, which are quite high here, going, oh, fuck it, I'm not sore, you know. Mm. And that's changed. That has an impact.
Absolutely.
So if you're paying taxes, as you said before, you have been helped by the state as well.
Yeah.
It isn't, please don't think like that.
Mm.
I've never met a drug addict or an alcoholic who wants to be one, ever. Generally, addiction is affiliated to people who can't deal with their pain. They've repressed it. They come from vicious circles of poverty. They never fucking stood a chance. You can take that any way you want. You can perceive it any way you want. But you know deep down in your gut that that's not right.
Mm.
And no matter what political spin or media spins put on it, in a country like Ireland, that's fucking bullshit. And it's happening far more than people might think.
And I think that you're absolutely right to say the political narrative, because, you know, the narrative went out around homelessness, you know, homelessness, our level of homelessness from the Taoiseach, that it was normal, that this stigmatization of people, this blaming of people, you know, for, you know, the poverty, like this blaming the poor, as someone said, you know, for poverty. And you're going, the structures of society create this, and it's somehow, you know, somehow, like, I just can't get over that it's deemed acceptable that we have, you know, over, I think it's 120, 130,000 children in, you know, deprivation, that we have, you know, 12,000 children have been made homeless. And I know the majority of people in this country don't agree with that. They don't want it. Yet our political narrative, as you say, and the political, you know, system and government is saying to them, you know, exactly that. It's, they're really, you know, they're after the handouts, they're after the benefits. You know, it's not, they're not working hard like you. And if we had a different government that spoke differently, that spoke about solidarity with people, like, I was thinking, remember thinking about homelessness, going, can you imagine you, the Taoiseach, who set up there, do you know what? We need to stop the country. We need to stop everything. And we're going to direct every bit of private resource we have for the next year, build homes, and we're going to get everybody who's homeless a home and build people homes. And as a country, we're going to work together and do that while we keep lots of other things going. But we're going to do it because, do you know what? This is what we should do as a country. No one, we know the suffering that's going on. And people probably go, do you know what? They're probably right. And we're going to give lots of people employment. We're going to train them up as, you know, builders doing different trades. We're going to say you have proper employment. We're going to set up a state building company that's going to guarantee employment into the future. And people go, yeah. And, you know, and they said, you know what? All the stuff about people being scumbags and people, you know, being their own fault. Actually, all the evidence shows the opposite. People would go in behind them.
Some people would then go, like, who's going to pay for it? That's the first thing you're going to hear, because economics is a very quick tool to throw out when you don't understand how it works and how it functions. And I'll tell you a story that actually, you talk about that kind of mindset. I did a bit of work in down in Limerick, in Moyross and South, you know, some of those areas in Limerick. And I remember saying to one guy, and he was just this brilliant character, and he just, like, he was robbing bikes all the time. And I just had this conversation. I was like, why are you robbing bikes all the time? Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, people worked for those things. And he went, I know. I think about it. He says, but you know how we think about things? I went, why? He says, and he was right on the money. He goes, the biggest criminals in this country weren't punished for what they did.
Mm.
How the fuck do you expect those to act?
Mm.
And people might go, take some personal responsibility. Yeah. It's easy for you to say that.
Yeah.
But the reality is, this guy was seeing rampant criminality at the highest systematic level. Mm. And he's going, I'm going to rob a fucking bike. And you're not going to give me a lecture about it, because who do you think you are? do you want to know where I came from?
Yeah.
And that's the reality. But the thing is, you're talking about that kind of mindset of like, let's stop the country, let's do that, and let's do the, you know, I'll be honest with you, I believe capitalism can work. I believe it can. I mean, I like to use this word, conscious capitalism, but I believe that the problem is with capitalism is that if you put power into any equation, it just taints everything. Power has the ability to overwrite everything. It overwrote every moral and ethic this country had when priests were sexually assaulting and abusing children, and people knew about that. When the Pope came to this country, I remember everyone going, "It's a disgrace, he's coming." The church knew about it. I remember everyone knew about this shit. Mm. You know, everybody, the guards, the people in the town, they knew about it. And for me, I look about systematic. You know, you're talking about homelessness. I'm kind of looking about, like, I keep going back to the time when we all turned a blind eye, society turned a blind eye to the fact that women were being put in prisons. That mindset, I wasn't I was only a child, but what was the political narrative then? Did they even bring it up? Was it discussed? Was there anything brought up? And then you look at the political narrative now, it's always twisted towards power. It's always twisted to more the maintenance of power. How do we keep power? Whether that's the Catholic Church or the state, it's how do we maintain power and how do we make sure it's not questioned? And that's the narrative we're seeing around equality now. And what the narrative's doing, Rory, is the fact that the middle class who have, let's be honest, they're absolutely, the squeezed middle class is absolutely on the money.
Mm.
What's happened to them is after the recession is they're all fucking terrified because basically a lot was taken from them. And now they've moved to this, a lot of people moved to this mode of self-preservation and they're going, oh my God, that was horrific. I hope that never happens again. The economy, my God, I hope that never happens again. And now we're playing off that from a political narrative.
But on the other hand, a lot of people, as a result of the crash, couldn't afford private health insurance.
Oh, yeah.
And are now dependent on a public health system. And see, even private health insurance only gets you so far, that you need a proper public health system. And if you look at the polls, the opinion polling is showing that the majority of people, for example, over the last two or three budgets, they do these polls, opinion polls before the budgets, were saying that we don't want tax breaks. We want investment in our public services. Mm. We want to have a proper public health system. And I think in a way that it's, as you've said, it's all to play for at the moment. We're at kind of a turning point. We're at this moment and COVID has really brought it to a head. People are really questioning, you know, why don't we have a public health system? People are saying about mental health, why are people not getting supports? I think there's a lot that we have shifted as a country to be much more, a lot more people are seeing the benefits and the necessity of public services, of a more solidarity society, a more cooperative society. And I think the question is not so much, are you in favour of capitalism, or are you not? The question is, what type of society do you want? Mm. And you aim for that and you use all sorts of different ways to get there. Because sometimes I think the capitalism socialism debate can be in a way pointless, because it's like create straw men to just label you at, and I'm just labeled a socialist and no one listens to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like
dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
like, whereas, I have socialist values. Like, I have certainly, and I think you're right, because it's and part of me is maybe I'm doing the labeling here, which is not what I wanted to do, because I do believe, like, I've always been quite very much left leaning, liberal, but like. Look, you talk about something there about the health system. Now, the reality is, it's not just about funding the health system. We look at our health system. Our health system is not, in European standards, is relatively funded. It's how the money's spent, how it's distributed, and the efficiency of the system. The system isn't efficient. You look in the mental health system, you know, there isn't, like, even the way it operates, it just doesn't operate. It is bombarded with administration. Because they're terrified around it. You look, like let's break down the mental health system to a very simple example. We don't have 24-hour mental health services in Ireland.
Yeah.
We do know that the vast majority of suicides happen in this country on Saturday nights and involve alcohol generally. There is, you know, they're not, mental health issues and over breakdowns and suicide, they don't operate office hours.
Mm.
You know, and this is the reality of it. But the reason we don't have 24-hour mental health services is not just because we can't get the staff for it. It's because once you get into that system, once you are brought into that system, there's a duty of care of that system to start a treatment plan with you and to get you somewhere. But what's happening now is they're just being given drugs and told to go the fuck home.
Mm.
And that is the system we have, because they can't bring people in and go, right, we're going to invest a number of weeks or months, whatever it takes, to find a way, to find a way to get your head to a place where you can deal with what's going on here. But that's a big commitment from a health system. That is a lot of work. That's a lot of therapy, and it's expensive. If I was a clinical psychologist, I would not work for that system. If you told me you're giving me $500,000 a year, I would not work for that system, because I couldn't look myself in the mirror to tell a suicidal teenage girl that I couldn't see her for 2 years. So the fundamental issue I see is we can keep plowing money into the health system, but that system isn't working, and it is a point of crisis system. It is only operating at point of crisis. And I'm not talking about the general health system, because I don't know enough about the other. This space. I look at mental health and I go, right now we spend 6% of our entire health budget on it. Six, which is nothing. The World Health Organization says a minimum of 13. 6%. I want to know what we spend it on, how we spend it. Another example is a friend of mine. You have to interview the head of psychology for the HSE, will tell you this stuff, Eddie Murphy. Like, he's like, it's a mess. They have to get dictaphones, or whatever you want to call them, Zoom recorders, to record interviews in some cases for legal reasons and other aspects, just for themselves. And one of my mates had to buy one, and it was €150 on Amazon. So he said to his supervisor, I have to buy this, I'll buy it and you can reimburse me. He goes, no, you have to buy it off this particular website. On that particular website, it was €320, but he had to buy it off that website. So there's this type of stuff, this inefficiency in the system, where money has been aimlessly spent. That's our money, that's taxpayers' money. So my fear about going to a purely public health system is, if it's the same system we have now, I wouldn't trust it.
And that is the thing, though, that it's part of the kind of the discussion and dialogue or narrative around it is, you know, the public system is bad, and essentially the people who have money get to the private one. And that has been the narrative. You know, Mary Harney was all about privatizing the public health system. You know, it's been all the way through. And we know that people who have money in this country have gone to the private health system, do you know what I mean? Or have private health insurance. And the thing about it is, though, I don't think we should accept that, you know, just because the system doesn't work and needs reform, that therefore the solution is let's privatize it, or let's have private systems where we know what they're about. Yes, they can deliver you the top class service if you have the money to get it. And it, you know, absolutely breeds and worsens inequality. And that the real issue is the need for the likes of you to highlight, okay, you know, our public system, how is it not working? Why is it not working? How could it work better? And you've pressured for that. And what have you found in terms of, like, just to come to a close, because you did a lot of direct lobbying around this, like politicians committed, yes, we'll do something about it, but they didn't.
Just quickly on the proper public private health system, I'd be very concerned right now. I understand the understanding around private and public. Without the private system now, it is taking a little bit of I know people are paying for it, heat off, but in terms of the private system, it is far from perfect when it comes to mental health supports. We just haven't figured that out. The private system is also generally, you know, quick fix. How do we kind of just get people from point of crisis? To me, the big thing around mental health and mental health journeys is it takes a lot of work. And it takes a lot of brilliant therapy and brilliant therapists. And my God, I have met some who have changed my life, and I've seen them change other people's lives. You get a good therapist, they are just a good psychologist, you know. And there's even from a psychiatry point of view, you know, as I said, many, many cases, medical model is required. But I really believe that in many cases, it's a holistic approach to your healthcare when it comes to mental health. We need to be given options. We need to be given the idea of, like, I need to maybe take medication, but maybe I need to, what happens when I have to come off the medication? Do I have the tools to deal with this shit? Do I have the deals to understand where my trauma came from? Was it my fault? Do I have the tools to address what happened in my childhood? This is stuff that we need to start doing. We stop looking at mental health like, my God, that person's broken. They've got a problem. Put them in the corner and let them go. No, let's help. And the problem with that, Rory, is it's a shitload of work. Just like the housing system. Homelessness is not just about putting homes over people's heads. There's much more to it. It's the same with mental health. It is complex. It's nuanced. But it requires far bigger thinking. When it comes to lobbying government around the area, I remember about, not this election, the election beforehand, I was in Lanzarote. I was like in this absolute shitty hotel with terrible wireless. And the only place to get wireless was down in, like, right on the reception. You'd have to be sitting on the reception table to get it. And it was about three debates into the leaders' debates, and I was watching them, and I was getting more and more sickened and deflated by them because nobody was mentioning mental health. And that same week, two people I knew closely died from suicide. I hear about this all the time. People reach out to me about being like helpless mothers, helpless fathers. I see it every day. I have seen and heard stories that absolutely have brought me to my knees. And it isn't here and there. It's every fucking day.
Mm.
And I sat there and watched our leaders not talk about the biggest issue I believe was facing our society, was the emotional well-being of its citizens. And I remember crying, and then I just started tweeting them. I just randomly started tweeting, like, Enda Kenny, Fine Gael, Labour, Sinn Féin, Social Democrats, going, where's your manifesto? Show it to me. Why the fuck aren't you talking about this?
Mm.
They started sending me some manifestos. They're like, that was the one you sent me last time. Where's your new manifesto for this election? I got really angry. And like some of them got back to me and went, bullshit, lads, bullshit. I'm calling bullshit on this. And then so many people started getting behind me. And so on. Actually, yeah, that's interesting. Show, why aren't you talking about this shit?
Yeah.
And then a prominent RT journalist asked me, would I help compile some questions for the leaders' debate?
Yeah.
Which I said, yes, I'll take the time out of my holiday to do that. And I did. And I came up with some questions, some basic questions around things like dual diagnosis, like 24/7 mental health care, funding, that kind of stuff. We've been working with mental health reform. They've been amazing around statistics to help us be better advocacy work around it. So we knew we had our shit together. Not one of those questions was asked in that debate. And I firmly believe that they were told not to ask those questions. And something else happened that week where another friend of mine who lost somebody through suicide was meant to do an interview on The Late Late Show, and they pulled it the week of the election because they had a more pressing election issue, which turned out to be, I don't know, some girl talking about a book.
Yeah.
So for me, why are they so terrified of having this conversation? I understand why. I empathize with them. Whether you hate politicians or not, not you, but people go, oh, boo, politicians. I don't hate them. I empathize with them in this area because they're the same people who were repressed that I was.
Mm-hmm.
They're the same people who went through 40, 50 years of sidestepping emotion and not talking about it. They're not going to be able to be feckin' Dawson's Creek episode in an election because they don't have the language. They don't have the tools to do that. It isn't part of politics. So I do empathize with them, but they're fucking leaders.
Mm.
Their job is to lead. Their job is to pull themselves out of comfort zones, to do things. And do I believe we're doing enough? No, we're not. It is not. It's 6-7 years that I've been working in this space. I've watched society do its job. I've watched them erode the stigma. I've watched people have conversations with their friends, with their schools. But I've also watched, and this isn't political because no political party has got this right. Mind you, it's only been Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in power generally in Labour, but none of them have addressed this. And I wasn't that impressed with Sinn Féin's manifesto either.
Mm.
And that's just the reality of it, because I don't think they get it. I really don't, and I want them to. And I also walked into a minister who said to me, not the first thing, God, lovely person, but they went, what's going on out there, Pressy? And I just sat there,
my God.
And I just felt like I didn't feel sad. I felt worried.
Yeah.
And I still feel worried. But like you in housing, do I believe there's solutions? Yes, I do. I absolutely do believe there's solutions here. I believe the solutions are that stop waiting for people to make this a political issue. Stop waiting for people to vote on this. Your job is to protect the citizens of this country. And there's people dying up and down the country. There's people who are simply not able to cope with life. There's people who've lost loved ones and don't know what to do about it. Stop looking at the NGOs to pick up all the pieces all the time. You've got to stand up and do fucking something here. But the reality is, we'll help. We'll come with you. We don't want to fight with you. Because we don't know the answers either. But we're not going to fucking figure them out by just not talking about it. Because that hasn't got us very far when it comes to mental health in this country. And it's now time to open that Pandora's box and address this stuff, as difficult as that's going to be, because every one of those politicians, every single one of them, have dealt with this personally. I guarantee it, from a loved one to a family member or to a friend or to themselves. So stop being terrified for this. And that's the only way we're going to change that.
Great. Brezzy, thanks so much for joining me on Reboot Republic today. It was great to have you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.